From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. We'll have open lines for you. At the end of the program tonight, we're going to start the guest earlier tonight, give you a little change of heart, a little treat. Well, here's some of the news of the day. Iran's foreign minister has backed off a prediction that a detained British servicewoman could be freed on Wednesday or Thursday, but said that Tehran agreed to allow British officials to meet with 15 sailors and Marines in Iranian custody. The foreign minister said in an interview that Britain must first admit that its sailors entered Iranian waters for the standoff to be resolved. Meanwhile, the price of oil is going up, up, up. Oil prices remain high, with traders worried about the possibility of supply disruptions from the Middle East. Overnight, by the way, on Tuesday, an erroneous rumor that a U.S. naval vessel had clashed with Iranian forces, erroneous rumor, sent the cost of crude shooting up by $5 a barrel in just a few minutes. China and Russia are shaking hands. They'll joint a effort to explore Mars and one of its moons in 2009. A Russian rocket will lift a Chinese satellite and Russian exploration vehicles to survey the Mars and Phobos, the innermost and biggest of the red planet's moons. Isn't this interesting? San Francisco's Board of Supervisors has voted to become the very first U.S. city to ban plastic bags from large supermarkets to help promote recycling. Under the legislation, beginning in 6 months, large supermarkets and drugstores will not be allowed to offer plastic bags made from petroleum products. Well, a 16-year-old girl from Hawaii was ordered off a Continental Airlines flight after she began uncontrollably coughing in her seat. The high school student, Rachel Collier, was returning to Honolulu from a spring trip to New York and Washington when she began to cough in her airplane seat. The girl's family said the pilot ordered the girl off the flight because she was ill. Well, we're starting to hear some word finally from Pope Benedict XVI. He's a quiet pope, but he says that hell is a place where sinners really do burn in an everlasting fire, and not just a religious symbol designed to galvanize the faithful. Addressing a Paris gathering in a northern suburb of Rome, Pope Benedict XVI said that in the modern world, many people, including some believers, had forgotten that if they failed to admit blame and promise to sin no more, that they risked eternal damnation, the inferno. You know, for 300 years, Western science has assigned the soul and the mind to oblivion. The soul has been considered a fantasy. The mind has been identified as a byproduct of the brain's chemistry. But what happens when they two join? In a moment, Dr. Larry Dossey explains on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Larry Dossey is a physician of internal medicine. After graduating with high honors from the University of Texas, he received his MD degree from Southwestern Medical School. Following internship, he served as a battalion surgeon in Vietnam, later completing his residency in internal medicine at the Veterans Administration Hospital and Parkland Hospital in Dallas. That, by the way, the Parkland Hospital is where John F. Kennedy was taken during that horrible tragedy in 1963. In 1988, he delivered the annual Mahatma Gandhi Memorial Lecture in New Delhi, India, the only physician ever invited to do so. Dr. Dossey is the former co-chairman of the Panel on Mind-Body Interventions, the Office of Alternative Medicine, National Institutes of Health. He was a founder and executive editor of Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine and is currently executive editor of Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Dr. Dossey, hey, Larry, how are you?
Hey, George, it's great to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Good to have you. You know, I think it is so fantastic that mainstream medicine, physicians begin to get involved in alternative medicine and look for different ways, in addition to treating people conventionally, by just looking at the things you've looked at. What got you around that corner, or were you always that way?
Well, to tell you the truth, George, I can't remember not being interested in some of these complementary forms of therapy that are taking their place alongside conventional methods. It just seemed right to me that modern high-tech medicine didn't have all of the answers. I remember an experience I had when I was a senior at the University of Texas at Austin. I was preparing to enter medical school that fall, and but before I got my degree and graduated, I came down with acute appendicitis. And like a dutiful student, I went over and turned myself into the student health center because I thought that's just what you did.
Sure.
It was an interesting experience, to say the very least. I never met the surgeon ahead of time. He just didn't think it necessary. I didn't meet the anesthesiologist either. He was too busy. So I had an operation without ever meeting my surgeon. And when I woke up, I still didn't know what the problem was. Still no surgeon anywhere in sight. And I was scared and alone and anxious, as you might imagine. And then something amazing happened. A nurse came by, and all she did was simply touch and hold my hand, and she said, "Larry, don't worry. Everything is going to be just fine." And it was as if I was zapped, George, I swear. The pain went away. All of the anxiety and tension and fear vanished, and I didn't know what had happened.
You sure that wasn't your guardian angel, Larry?
You know, she might easily have been one, but I knew that something extraordinary had happened, and it was extremely simple. It had nothing to do with my receiving any kind of injections or any kind of medication, and that moment was seared into my brain, and I've never been able to forget about it. And it's moments like that that have made me wonder, you know, why we don't pay more attention to these extraordinarily simple things that have a huge potential to make us feel better and get well.
Do you think she had the gift of healing?
Yeah, George, she had the gift. But see, the problem with me at the time, I didn't even know what a healer was. I was a college senior, and
sure.
You know, healing was not even in my vocabulary at the time. In retrospect, this woman was a healer. She had the gift, and she knew what she was doing, and she was a powerful healer. I know that now, but I didn't know it at the time.
Do you think all of us have the capability of you know, and I would never, I'm not a doctor, by the way, I always qualify that, I'd never advocate somebody to get off their medication and their drugs. I always tell them, consult your physician, do what you have to do. But do you think that we all have the capability to heal ourselves?
I think that it's there in varying degrees in people. And I would take it even one step beyond that, George. I think that there are people out there who, like this nurse, have the capacity to help heal other people as well. I think that capacity is very widespread, but I also think that there are people who have it in the same way that there are prodigies in just about everything else, including mathematics and music and athletics. There are some people who really have the gift in spades. They're just blessed with it. I'm not sure what the origin of that is, but I think that in some of the experiments and clinical studies that we have done in healing, I think we can identify people like that who are truly gifted as far as healing is concerned.
You have written some marvelous stories in The Extraordinary Healing Power of Ordinary Things, your book, your work, and you looked at some of the problems with modern medicine, which kind of pushed you in that direction to write this book, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, one of the statistics which really grabbed my attention and focused my mind on these simple, low-tech, very safe and very inexpensive methods of staying healthy was a set of statistics that was published around 6 or 7 years ago in the Journal of the American Medical Association having to do with the problems as far as safety is concerned,
right,
in conventional medicine. The statistics show that each year in this country, around 225,000 people die in our hospitals because of the side effects of medications.
Oh, my God.
And because of the errors committed by hospital personnel from, you know, surgeons, physicians of all sorts, nursing personnel, and so on. If you do the math, this makes hospital care in our country the third leading cause of death, right behind heart disease and cancer. There's something wrong with this picture, you know, and it ought to trouble everybody. But the fact is that it just sort of, you know, floats under the radar screen year after year, and it should be a national scandal, but it really isn't. We need to be alarmed by it and disturbed by it. It needs to bother us. And I think it needs to prompt us to ask whether or not there are not safer, less lethal methods of improving our health than are always available through conventional medicine.
Now, this is an extreme, but I saw a story just yesterday that said that they are recommending that drugs be used first before angioplasty, that it seems that conventional drugs given to people with heart problems and problems in their arteries are better off than angioplasty. Now, I thought for a moment, okay, is this a study put on by drug companies? What is this? Did you see that story?
Yeah, I did. I followed that, and I think you're very wise to suggest that we do follow the money. That's always a good thing to do. But, George, let me raise the ante just a little bit farther. There are studies now that have been done by Dr. Dean Ornish, and they've been replicated by other people, that show clearly by non-drug and non-surgical methods, one can open up coronary arteries that are obstructed, even when people have severe angina, the pain from obstructed coronary vessels, through diet, through gentle exercise, and through group therapy where people attend to stress reduction. So, you know, we ought to be emphasizing these methods because they are so safe, they are effective, they've been replicated. Insurance companies are even reimbursing these days for these things because of one reason, because they work. So this is the point that I continue to try to emphasize over and over, that we ought to look at these low-tech, high-touch, inexpensive, freely available methods rather than opt for surgery or even for drugs, as far as that's concerned, except in emergency situations and in critical, urgent situations.
Exactly. You know, and I'm not throwing stones at medications. I think in some cases they probably have worked wonders for people, but there's a way to alternatively try to solve some of your problems and health issues as well.
Well, I think the key word might be balance. You know, we've gotten terribly unbalanced in medicine, where our first option tends to be high-tech, surgical, or pharmaceutical. I just think that there's another way. And I want to join you in adding that I'm convinced that there is a place for high-tech medicine. As an internist, I've used those methods all my life. But I think that they should be used wisely and not always as a first option.
Absolutely. Now, you are very interested in what you call ordinary things that have healing powers. What do you mean by ordinary things?
Well, you know, there's an old saying that if you want to hide the treasure, all you do is put it in plain sight.
Just put it right there on the table.
Right, and then nobody will see it.
Because, exactly.
You know, you don't expect something that valuable to be open and in full view. These things that have healing power that are very ordinary or are just so common that, you know, I almost wanted to say common as dirt. And actually, that's one of the chapters in the book, which we may talk about a little bit later.
Yes, we will. I've got that circled, by the way.
The healing power and the virtues of honest to God, dirt. Simple things that people ordinarily don't consider to be therapeutic, such as optimism, the sense of novelty, crying, plants, risk-taking, music, things like that. These are just ordinary things that are all around us that have a tremendous healing power once one looks at the data surrounding the science here. So that's what I've tried to do, is to bring together these ordinary, simple things that fly under the radar screen which we ordinarily do not put into the category of therapies, but which indeed are.
The medical community, when you tell them about alternative ways to practice, overall, what do they say to you? What do they say in general?
Well, you know, 20 years ago, it was considered laughable that one would even bring these things up. But pretty much everybody knows what's happened since that time. There was a grassroots movement in America whereby people started voting with their feet. They started going to alternative therapists that did one thing or another. They started going to health stores. They started jogging and so on. You know, back when I was practicing medicine in Dallas in those early days, we referred, well, I didn't, but many people referred to those patients who opted for those things as health nuts. You know, this was not a very complimentary way to talk about your patients, but that's the term people, physicians used. Since that time, most physicians realized that the train has left the station. There's no turning back. More people now in the United States visit the offices of alternative therapists in a year's time than visit frontline physicians, such as internists and family doctors. So if for no other reason than the fact that a lot of money is flying out of the front door, most doctors have begun to listen up and realize, perhaps kicking and screaming, that they have to pay attention to what's happening out there in the culture. This movement toward alternative and complementary medicine is one of the major social shifts that has happened in the dying years of the 20th century. And most doctors are satisfied now that they're going to have to come to terms with it. I'm happy to report that there's a real dialogue now about these issues, and I would just say it's about time.
I have become obsessed with health issues, and, you know, I can't read enough, Larry. Newsletters, books, articles, internet stories. I just keep reading things, and I'm very fascinated with natural supplements that research shows, for example, let's talk about our arteries, that it, you know, certain things reduce inflammation, certain things eradicate plaque, certain things, you know, clean out your arteries. And they, you know, they talk about some studies. There's one natural supplement I take where it showed a 3,000% decrease in the plaque in an artery. I mean, those things are incredible. And I think if people are smart, if they read, if they look, they will find ways to help themselves, won't they?
Well, that's a good way to put it. Because I think that the onus is on individuals to self-educate about these things. I think most people are going to be sorely disappointed if they wait for their own physicians to bring up a lot of these things that you mentioned. 20 years ago or so, it was difficult to find information, but you would have to be blind, deaf, and dumb not to be aware of all of the resources these days, particularly over the Internet, where people can, if they're critical, find reliable information about how to steer in these waters. So I just want to emphasize self-responsibility and self-education, George, just as you just did.
I think my doctor cringes whenever I make an appointment with him because I always bring him an article or two or something new for him to investigate and study. But you know, it's out there. You know, the National Institutes of Health, they're conducting a study with EDTA now. They're halfway into this thing. It's been a long, lengthy study. It's been years, but I think it's time for modern medicine to look at different ways.
Well, the EDTA you bring up is topical because in this month's issue of Discover magazine, there is a brilliant article by Jill Niemark, who is one of America's great science journalists, about the problems of autism. Autism is really in the news these days because it has become so prevalent. There's an epidemic of it now in our country. The EDTA issue comes in because many complementary therapists who treat children who are severely autistic have begun to use chelation EDTA therapy on these kids, sometimes with dramatic, almost miraculous results. The thinking is that the EDTA takes the mercury out of the tissues and the bloodstream of these kids, and in so doing, reduces the toxin load, which may have been responsible for autism in the first place.
Let's talk a little bit about that when we come back, and also these incredible titles you have for your chapters in your book. I mean, dirt, bugs, tears, miracles. Those are the name of chapters. We'll be back in a moment. Well, 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 let me tell you a little bit about what you've been doing for us for Children International. You're getting us on our way to our goal of sponsoring 350 children. We've had three successful campaigns. This is number four. So let's get going. Those of you who can afford $22 a month for 1 year, that's the commitment where your money will go and help a needy child. You can go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. On the left-hand side of the screen, you'll see a yellow flashing banner. Click that. That'll take you to Children International, where you can sponsor a child. And for the first 350 people who do this, you will get a free signed copy of my book, Worker in the Light, just our way of saying thank you for sponsoring a child through Children International. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Dr. Larry Dossey. Larry, some of the titles in your book, The Extraordinary Healing Power of Ordinary Things, also seem very strange. Dirt, bugs, tears, miracles, so on. First of all, how'd you select these titles?
Well, George, I did want them to seem a bit strange and outrageous. As a matter of fact, that's one of the criteria that I use to select these topics to include in the book. I wanted them to sort of be arresting for people and to grab their attention. But beyond that, the other criteria that all of these things had to meet in order to make the cut for the book is scientific credibility. You know, in the back of the book, there are about 20 to 30 pages of citations from the professional scientific literature supporting all the contentions in the book that these really are helpful things that can add to people's health. So outrageousness and scientific credibility were the two criteria that I used to select these things.
All right, let's go through each one, if we can, one at a time, and then we'll get into more of some of the issues here. Let's say dirt. What do you mean by the healing powers or the healing of dirt?
Well, we seem to have overdone it in America as far as hygiene is concerned. For about 10 years, there has been an idea that has been gathering steam. It began in England, but now is firmly rooted in the United States. It's a concept called the hygiene hypothesis. And this idea is that at certain stages in the development of the human immune system, basically when we're children, we need exposure to unhygienic conditions. Basically, we need to get dirty from time to time. Now, this may sound perverse, but there's a strong logic to it. The only way that our immune system get smart is by being confronted with viruses and bacteria and fungi and so on out in the environment. These are the things that are present in dirt. Now, one of the reasons for saying these strange-sounding things to people who bump into this for the first time is that we know that children who are raised in unhygienic environments are healthier than kids who are kept squeaky clean by their parents.
That is true.
Just as an example, kids who grow up in rural environments have a stronger immune system than kids who grow up in hygienic environments in the city. They have a lower incidence of certain diseases, including asthma. They have a lower incidence of infections, allergies, eczema, and so on. So there are definite health benefits to this periodic exposure to getting dirty. I grew up on a farm, and, you know, we didn't think anything about getting dirty. It was just part of life. I didn't know at the time that I was building up a pretty good cast-iron immune system by virtue of doing that, but that's what the research points to. Also, George, there are other ways for urban kids to enjoy these benefits. For example, kids who are raised in daycare settings also are exposed to, you know, just a soup of germs. And this, in the long run, is good for children. So I've often thought that this might come as some consolation to parents who feel a little bit bad about parking their kids in daycare. This is one of the benefits of it. The take-home lesson, I think, for parents is that we should not obsess about keeping our children squeaky clean all the time. As a matter of fact, that may be doing them a disservice. We need to bring back things like sandboxes and letting kids make mud pies, perhaps. My favorite example is helping kids grow a vegetable garden, because you can't do that without playing in the dirt.
Well, that's true. Well, now, give me your take on this. You know, I go between Los Angeles and St. Louis. When I'm in L.A. before a program, I'll catch a quick small dinner with my producer, Tommy. And he called me here in St. Louis last week panicking, Larry, just panicking, because while he was out at a restaurant, the waitress who was delivering his salad sneezed in her hands and then continued to pick up the plate of salad and carry it to Tommy's table. He calls me because he's kind of a germophobic. And, I mean, he's the kind of guy that walks around with one of those alcohol gel things that you squeeze into your hands.
We need to talk to Tom.
And anyway, he calls me and says, "Should I eat it? Should I eat it?" And then he went and explained what had happened. And I said, "Yeah, go ahead. It's not going to kill you." Did I say the right thing, or should he have said to her, "Hey, lady, you sneezed in your hands. You picked up my salad plate. I'm not eating these. I'm not going to have it."
You know, George, I hate to double cross you, but I'm on Tom's side on this one.
You are. Okay, how come?
Well,
what's different between that and the kids playing in dirt?
Well, Tom's immune system isn't developing right now. It's pretty much been ordered in the way that it's going to be for the rest of his life. The hygiene hypothesis applies to immune systems in children that are still plastic and are flexible and that are in the process of developing. So this is the time in life the younger years below age 10 generally, where one wants to take seriously the hygiene hypothesis and get exposed to a variety of germs. But I think by the time we're beyond adolescence, our immune system is pretty much instructed. And so in that particular situation, I think Tom was right being sort of edgy about that situation.
So he went ahead and he had his salad, and he doesn't feel good now. Isn't that interesting? Now, how much of that though, Dr. Dossie, is mind over matter?
Well, here's the interesting thing. This waitress more than likely had some sort of viral problem if she was sneezing and so on. And so viruses are not infectious if you eat them, for example, after they've contaminated a salad. If Tom had breathed the air that this woman sprayed with her viral cloud, that would have caused him a problem. It's not the actual behavior of eating the salad that would have made him sick. I don't know if he breathed in a toxic load of those viruses or not, or whether he's just nervous about being exposed to it.
It could be the Howard Hughes syndrome, right?
Well, it could be.
All right, now, twofold question. Question one leads to number two. The germs for the common cold, are they always out there?
They're always out there. I think what we ought to emphasize is that there are a lot of things that control whether we get sick from those germs other than the germs themselves.
Here's the second part of the question, though.
Yeah.
If the germs, for example, for the common cold are always out there, why don't we always come down with the cold? Only sometimes we come down with a cold.
Well, let me give you an example of a factor that plays into it, this issue of emotional stress. When I was in medical school, we knew statistically that during examination time, all other things being equal, we were going to have a higher incidence of colds and viral illnesses in our medical school class than at any other time. And no one had really worked out why, but we know now that under conditions of emotional stress and tension, that the immune system suffers. The immune cells are not as robust, they're not as active, and they're not as responsive as they are during times of placidity and serenity in our life. So this is just simply one factor that controls how we respond to the germs that are out there all the time.
Interesting. All right, let's move on to some of your other titles. Bugs.
Bugs is a metaphor for creepy crawly things in general, George. And the two bugs, end quote, that I single out to focus on that have made a real comeback in medicine are, believe it or not, maggots and leeches. We thought we had done with these things back in the early days of the 20th century, and they were simply banished to the sidelines of modern medicine when antibiotics came in. But the situation is that we have so many infections now that are resistant to antibiotics that there are situations in where these particular forms of therapy are really making a comeback. I'll give you one example. After the Pentagon was hit by the terrorist attack, the airplane flew into it.
Of course, some of us might say maybe.
Maybe. Yeah, we can wrap that and yeah. bracket that and set it aside. But Lieutenant Kevin Schaefer was on duty at the Pentagon, and he suffered burns over a good proportion of his body, and he was taken to the hospital where he developed one of these hospital-acquired infections. He was dying from this, but his physician had the presence of mind to do something which physicians are doing increasingly these days, which was to order maggot therapy for Lieutenant Schaefer. These maggots were applied to the infected flesh, the burns, and they cleaned them up in rapid order. And most people who have examined this case credit maggot therapy with saving this young man's life. This is just one dramatic example.
That is dramatic.
It is. You know, these things can be a life and death issue. If you've got one of these resistant infections, you'll be willing, I think, in fact, in spite of what's been called the yuck factor, to invoke some of these creepy crawlies on your behalf. These are particularly useful in infections in the lower extremities of diabetics, where the circulation is impaired and where amputation can be a real issue anytime one of these infections really gets rampaging. Maggots have been used successfully all across the country, and I think people are just beginning to wake up to what's going on out there now in our hospital when these things are coming back from the sidelines.
Now, that's pretty gutsy, though. I mean, if some practitioner recommended, let's use maggots on you, George, man, I'd kind of cringe on that one, Larry.
There are many stories in the book of people who, when confronted, George, with this therapeutic option, did exactly that. They just reacted with disgust. But there usually is a point where people will say, look, no matter if I have to hold my nose and I refuse to look at the things, if they're going to save my life, I'm going to go for it. And that is an increasingly common situation where people are finding themselves these days.
All right, tears. Tell me about that one.
Yeah, well, you know, tears, we're not supposed to cry when we get sick, right? You know, stiff upper lip, chin out, and all of that. Big boys don't cry. But tears are back as a proper form of therapy, if you will, in certain instances. The Japanese rocked the medical world about 4 years ago when they published a study with patients with severe rheumatoid arthritis. They got a bunch of these patients and showed them severely wrenching pictures, which were emotionally unsettling, the kind of pictures that would just drive many people to tears just to view them. Now, what happened was really fascinating. Some of the rheumatoid patients did permit themselves to cry in response to these pictures, while roughly half of these rheumatoid patients could not let themselves cry. They followed these patients for a year, and as it turned out, the rheumatoid patients who permitted themselves to shed tears went into remission. Their joints got better, they consumed fewer pain pills, and they looked at the immune indicators in the blood of all of these patients. In the patients who could cry, the natural killer cells, the CD4, CD8 immune cells, all went in the right direction. Inflammation indicators in the blood took a nosedive.
That's remarkable.
Well, it is. Now, this is only one disease, but this area of research showing the value of tears, I think, is off and running. I predict that there are going to be an increasing number of illness entities where we're able to show the virtue of crying.
That is one of the strangest stories I've heard.
It's one of the best design studies I know of. It's so crisp and clear, it's hard for skeptics to poke holes in it. And I adore that study, to tell you the truth. And I think that it just says something to parents. You know, instead of instructing our children to just sort of clam up and be emotionally grim and silent, we ought to be encouraging our kids that the proper thing is to let yourself cry. That's a lesson kids need to learn early.
And miracles? I would guess miracles, that subject matter for one of your chapters, would fit the same mode?
Yep. As far as I can see, miracles deserve a much greater place than we've given them. When I was in medical school, we were told that miracles just flat out don't happen. You can practice medicine all your life, and you're lucky if you see anything even approaching a miracle. But that way of looking at things, George, has been turned upside down. A couple of years ago, there was a national study of doctors of all major subspecialties which inquired about what they think about miracles. 75% of doctors who responded anonymously, and that's really important. You have to ask doctors this on the sly so they know that they won't be reported in terms of what they believe about this. But if you ask them anonymously, 3/4 say that they believe miracles occurred in the past. 3/4 say that they are certain that miracles still occur. And get this is a shocker. 55% of those doctors in America say that they have actually seen miracles occur in their own patients. You know, this is just not supposed to be what doctors think. But when you ask them anonymously, you get a different picture. So I've described some of these miracles, and if you wish, we can talk about what these things look like in real life.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've got another hour to go with you, and then we're going to take another hour of phone calls after this, Larry. So we've got a lot of time to talk about these. Tell me a little bit about where people can get your book, The Extraordinary Healing Power of Ordinary Things.
Well, since it's published by Random House, it's available, George, at all major bookstores and the usual internet sites such as Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Powell. So any of those sites will do.
Website linked up at coasttocoastam.com, but it's dossey.com. dossey.com, right?
That's correct, dossey.com. It's two Dossies because my wife, who's also an author, we share the website, so that's Dossey twice.
Have mainstream practitioners turned on you, or do they support you?
You know, I get to ask this all the time. I think most people, or many people, think that if I talk about these things in medical schools these days, I'm get run out with tomatoes thrown at me. That just never happens. I have the opportunity, I'm happy to say, to speak to medical schools all over the country, which I've done for years. And the reception is invariably cordial and respectful. I know the language of doctors and what they find convincing, and I know the language of science, and that's why I get away with talking about these things. I will acknowledge, however, that 20 years ago this was not the case. Particularly in the area of spirituality and medicine, there was no dialogue at all 20 years ago. But that has just changed dramatically. Just as an indicator, in 1993, when I wrote a book called Healing Words, which dealt with prayer and medicine, only three of our country's 120 medical schools had any kind of coursework looking at this area. But now it's been dramatically different because 90 of our nation's medical schools actually have coursework exploring these issues. Many of which, I'm happy to say, use my books as reference books and textbooks.
All right. Well,
it's a whole new day.
When we come back, Larry, we're going to talk about miracles. We're going to talk about music, and we're going to talk about some other issues here. Then later on, we will open up the phone lines. not only to ask Dr. Dossie a question, but I want you to share your experiences if miracles and things like that have affected your life, have changed your health. And then the last hour of the program tonight, the very last hour, open lines. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.